Hey everybody, Ethan here. Today we're talking about Joker, and we discuss a lot of really important psychological issues. It's a fascinating episode, but what we don't talk about is how skinny Joaquin Phoenix got for this role and how he did it. He did it by eating 300 calories a day, and I know what you're thinking, that's impossible. That's not enough food. I would be so hungry. But I'm here to offer you some little snacks that are 300 calories a day. I've been doing it now for weeks, and it's just so easy. Today I had 2 full-fat mozzarella cheese sticks and a quarter cup of almonds. That's 300 calories, okay? I mean, that's a ton of food. I'm full. Here's another one. A cup of 2% cottage cheese and a half cup of a banana. You gotta mash it up to measure that right. And trust me, it's a ton of food. Wait, what if you're vegan, right? You don't want to have cottage cheese. You don't want to have mozzarella. You can just have 3.5 cups of coconut popcorn. And that's it. You can have it for lunch or dinner or, well, you can't do both.
But what about bagels? I love bagels.
Well, no problem. You can have one sprouted whole grain bagel with 1 tablespoon of nut butter. It's unbelievable. So as you can see, there's a million options. It's actually a really easy diet. 300 calories a day, you'll shed those pounds and you'll be looking like a hot, sexy Joker in no time. Enjoy the program.
Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we have to fight?
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bad Science. I'm Ethan Edinburgh, and today we are talking about Joker. It's the highest grossing rated R film ever made, which I didn't know until this morning.
Really?
Very surprising, yes. Wow. The 2 shocked people right in front of me, I will introduce right now. First of all, a comedian and writer, Danny Palumbo.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Danny, you're also a food writer, is that correct?
Yeah. I don't write like actual intelligent things.
wait a minute. What does that mean?
I write about like chicken parmesan.
Okay.
It's not, but thank you so much. I will take.
You're very welcome.
I'll take
and
writer.
I would prefer if half of this podcast was just about chicken parmesan. I love chicken parm.
We can do it. Yeah.
Okay, good. So before we get into that, I want to introduce our other guest. She is a journalist, a science communicator, and author, Kara Santa Maria.
Hi.
How's it going, Kara?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for joining us. You also have a podcast. In fact, you were telling me you have 2 podcasts.
Yeah. So I have a podcast, Talk Nerdy, where I interview scientists every week.
Correct.
Science writer. And then I'm also the 5th rogue. We call ourselves rogues.
Ooh.
Because we are massive nerds.
Okay.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. So that show's been around for, I think, 14 years now, which is
yes.
Wild.
Ancient
bananas.
For podcasts. Yes.
I know.
It's the dinosaur of podcasts.
It is. And I've been on it for about 5 years with the guys.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. And you are also a field host for the reboot of Brain Games.
Yes. Yeah, so on National
correct?
Geographic. New show. I mean, old show, newly reimagined.
Okay.
So hosted by Keegan-Michael Key. I'm the field correspondent and I drop some science on the show. And
awesome.
And there's also Lior Suchard, who is the master mentalist, as they call him.
The master mentalist?
Yeah.
Why don't you have a cool title like that?
Yeah. My title
awesome.
Is just nerd. So, yeah, I mean, in my background, I have a master's in neuroscience. I was a working neuroscientist for several years. And now I've actually, years later, after doing all this work in science communication, decided to go back to school. And I'm a 3rd-year PhD student in clinical psychology,
okay.
which I think is very relevant to this topic today.
Yes.
And, yeah, and I see patients.
Am I the dumbest person in the room right now?
No.
That is
always me.
You think you got it?
With a bullet.
All
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Big time.
Ask me about sports and your opinion will change.
I mean, honestly, it's one of those things I feel like where maybe the more you know about sports, the dumber you are. I don't want to make that generalization.
Yeah.
I feel like that might be true.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It's like, why do I know so many stats about basketball? It's not going to help me in life.
Yeah.
It's not going to help me learn or
same
teach.
Way about baseball.
I bet you though, I bet you knowing those things has actually helped you secure a job before, has helped you make friends. It's actually been a great social lubricant.
But those friends suck.
Yeah.
These guys are idiots, man. They are jerks. Okay, but yeah, we are talking about Joker today.
I
had not seen this movie until yesterday. I think Danny the same.
Same thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did you guys feel when you first saw the movie? I'll start with you guys. Did you enjoy the movie? Because it was very hyped.
Yeah, it was so hyped. And then I heard some things from different people. Like a lot of people were like, you're going to love it. You're going to love it because of your background in science or psychology. Oh. And then I've heard from other people, you're going to hate it. You're going to hate it because like all the incels really love this movie. And
right.
there's a whole thing around that.
Yes.
So I was interested, and I don't think it let me down. I think it's exactly what I expected it to be.
Okay.
Nothing more, nothing less.
Sort of. I think everyone kind of knew it would be a little uncomfortable.
Right.
Right. I'm on Twitter all day. Like, I'm on the internet way too much. So it's like this movie kind of got ruined a little bit early on. I was like, I'm not going to see it because everyone has an opinion about it.
Right.
And I'm like, I would just rather think about something else.
Chicken parm.
Yeah. Chicken parm. mm-hmm. Sports stats. So I was like, I didn't watch it until you assigned it as homework.
Yes.
And I enjoyed it.
Great.
I liked it. Even, you know, as a fan of like, even sort of like, comic book movies and stuff and like Batman, I was like, oh, this is a good iteration of that.
Yes.
There were some things where I was like, oh, I like what they did with like the Wayne family and like, you know, like, yeah. Of course they would be rich assholes, you know?
Right.
Like I kind of liked that aspect of it, but yeah, it made me very uncomfortable.
Yes, a lot. Also.
But I did enjoy it.
I like movies that make me feel a little uncomfortable.
Sure.
Yeah, first off. And I think it has to be said that Joaquin Phoenix's performance is really what carries this film, right?
Yes.
I mean, he was just absolutely tremendous.
Yeah.
Cannot take your eyes off him.
Yeah.
And yeah, I simultaneously was let down a little bit from the movie, but then also really excited and thought it was like super unique that this was a quote unquote like superhero movie, because he's like a villain in the superhero universe, but felt like a real movie. It felt like a real guy, real life, dark. Dark, you know, gritty film. And I hope that because it's so successful, they keep making this kind of lower budget superhero movie.
Right, as opposed to sort of what Marvel did.
And
like,
yes.
See, that's what I was thinking too, is like, well, this is still better than like, you know, shoving another Marvel character down our throats.
Right.
Where like, you know, every step and beat that's going to happen in the movie. I'm like, at least this is challenging something.
Yeah.
But to be fair, I think the anti-hero character of Joker allows for that more than some of these other, like, if you have a superhero who has to be able to like fly or like transform into a Hulk, like I think you have to show people that in the movie. And that's probably why so many comic book movies lend themselves to these like big budget, lots of CG.
Right.
And Joker didn't require that. But like you guys, I think that's why I liked it more, because unlike you, I actually like legit hate comic book movies. It's not, I'm not really into fantasy films or like superhero films that much. I'm much more into like thinky, gritty, like, and so I think this movie really sat well with me. But also I think because of that, it was like, it was good. Like, it was good, but it wasn't like mind-blowing to me, because I watch movies like this all the time.
Yeah, yeah,
whereas
I agree.
For people who expected a comic book movie, they were like, what is this?
Yeah.
Maybe that's why I like Batman. Like, he's grounded a little more in reality.
Yeah, he's like a real dude who like doesn't have powers.
Right,
right.
And Joker works as an origin story for Batman too. Which is like, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, although what an idiot Batman as a kid is. Yeah. He just lets a stranger through a gate, put his fingers in his mouth and shit.
Yes.
Did they teach him nothing? Yeah. What was that scene? I couldn't believe that.
I
Well, how old was he again?
I don't know.
10?
10?
10? 8?
And
we were like,
why do we know exactly?
Why do we know
that he's
exactly?
10?
But his parents were also not around, right?
Yeah,
like he was raised by like servants or something.
You're right.
Like,
that's
he didn't really have a lot of social skills.
That's true.
And I feel like that could explain like his disconnect a little bit. And
okay. So it makes it.
And also, he was lonely, right? And I think the whole thing was he was like, "I'm your brother." Like, I just made a massive spoiler.
Oh no, the whole thing is spoiler.
Oh,
if you haven't seen Joker,
literally the spoileriest of all the spoilers of the whole movie.
Oh, we'll spoil the whole thing.
But yeah, like I think the kid was like, "No way!" Like I have somebody else, like who's weird and interesting. Like, let's be friends.
I think I would instantaneously hate my brother if he put his fingers in my mouth.
Yeah. I don't know, man. There's something about Joker. There's something about Joaquin Phoenix that's like, I'm very ambivalent about. Like, he's, you know, a quote unquote monster. Of course he is. The horrible things that he does in the film, it's very easy to go, what a psychopath. And, you know, we'll get into what all those words mean and whether they're appropriate. But but there's also something very sad about him and something very human. And I think there's a part of you that just wants to like make it better.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And in addition, I mean, he looks, I mean, he's so skinny in the film.
Yeah.
But
right,
I was in a little rough in the face a little bit, you know, but there was something I was thinking too, which is like, he does kind of have like kind of a kind face.
Yeah.
Just the way that he looks.
Yes. Yes.
You kind of feel for him a little bit.
And I've always gravitated towards shy people.
Yeah.
And I think he also has that quality to him where it's like you just feel like you want him to win. You want people to treat him nicely. And it's like 99% of the people in this movie just crap on him.
Yeah.
And you just automatically, feel for him. Which I also wanted to bring up, do you think that that's like healthy or not? Because of the whole incel, you know, it's definitely making a comment on, you know, mass shooters and like American terrorism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, are we... Does the movie paint him in a good light in certain ways? Because obviously he's the bad guy in Batman, but in this movie he's like the main character. So you could kind of argue both ways a little
bit. Yeah, he's like he's an anti-hero, right? So he is the protagonist of this movie, but he plays that role of anti-hero. And I think you have to approach that from two different perspectives. So one is it ethical or is it was it okay for them to portray a mentally ill violent person in a very vulnerable way. Absolutely. I think that what this movie does really well is it helps you to empathize with people from all stripes of life and people who ultimately do commit crime, sure. But I think we have a tendency in our society to look at people in the criminal justice system as like evil,
right,
instead of as people who are desperate or people who have had a series of significant life events who have led them into these circumstances.
Yep.
That said, I don't think that what this movie does is glorify this guy. If it did, I might agree that this is a dangerous thing for, like, the incel movement.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't actually commit any incel-related crimes in the film because right. you still never know what happened with the neighbor.
Yeah, it could be his delusion.
Yeah, that's the
right.
one
right.
thing that you
that's
don't
true.
Know ultimately what how it ends because they just leave it at that.
Yeah.
And so all of the crimes that he commits are actually towards other men, and they don't propagate the kind of anti-woman, you know, sex is a currency, you owe me sex
right.
mentality in the film,
right.
which is good. So if incels are identifying with it, they're identifying it with it in the sense that this is a guy who's been, you know, treated like shit his whole life. He's a guy who's never really, like, had a chance. But they're not identifying with the anti-woman hatred, which, thank God, because that would
yes.
be a totally different movie.
Yes.
And I think there would be much more
And that would
outrage.
Kind of crystallize
yeah,
it a
yeah,
little
yeah.
bit, too.
Yeah.
Like, well, that this is for sure mm-hmm. incel sort of
Absolutely.
Behavior. It didn't strike me as any different than, like, a serial killer origin story where it's like, you know, they kind of harp on, like, but they had, like, a rough childhood.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly.
So I wasn't viewing this as, like, oh, this is, like, new information. Like, we kind of know this.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
However, there are sections where it's, like, visually he's dancing and there's, like, the cool stadium music. And then there's, like, him, like, at
yeah,
the car and everybody's
okay.
cheering him on. He has this whole, you know, the city's behind him.
Right. Yes.
So I felt like, I don't know, there was like a slippery slope situation a couple times.
Yeah, yeah, know? Yeah. Of kind of like, and I mean, for good reason, because of course, I think a lot of the readings that have come out around this film have to do with the fact that there's like a violent crime, usually gun-related homicide or attempted homicide committed by a man in this country like daily.
Yeah.
Right? And so, and the same kind of motivations can be there. And so it's this kind of complicated picture of we want to understand why and we want to be able to exercise empathy without condoning this behavior, right? Mm-hmm. I want to get where these people are coming from so that we can help them sooner, so that we can be more yep. involved in rehabilitation. At the same time, we don't want to glorify this.
Yeah.
But this isn't a news report.
Right.
This is art.
A
this
movie.
Is a film.
Yes.
And also, you know, I think that the important thing, have you guys seen this amazing show on Showtime called Active Shooter?
No.
It's really an important show. They unfortunately cut it short because I think the first air date was right around the big Las Vegas shooting, which was like rocked our worlds, right? It was like one of the most
terrible.
Yeah, terrible. And so I think people were like, oh my God, this show is, I don't know how I feel about it. But it's a documentary series following big active shooter incidents and helping to really understand how the responses took place, what law enforcement could learn from them. But it takes the approach in episode one of talking to the victims' families, and they really push for an important change in how we report these kinds of violent events.
Yeah,
and they talk about the fact that, yes, it's important if we've identified the shooter, say their name once, and after that, call them the shooter.
Yep.
Do not show their photo over and over again.
Right.
Do not give them what they wanted out of this, which is to go down in history as the shooter. And so in that respect, right, because Joker is the anti-hero and we're, you know, we love him and people are cheering for him.
They're all putting on the mask and like
if somebody, a young guy who's feeling very slighted by life, you know, who's like has all those features of a developing potential killer sees this, is he going to see it as, oh, I could be like Joker? Yeah, that's the real question.
Did it inspire anything?
I mean,
was there like a news story where like, because I mean, I was going to say too, like I get the uncomfortableness before I even saw this movie. I mean, like maybe like a month or so ago, just saw a guy walking down Hollywood towards me, full Joker makeup suit and like walking like this guy's trying to start a fight. And kind of he had something in his hand. You know what it was? I just remember for a second I like clamped up. I was like, no, this is behavior I don't
I don't
like.
Do you think if anything it just inspired you to be more on guard when you see something in a Joker
right
costume?
Now it's like we all know everyone knows.
I'm pretty much on guard all the time no matter what.
I don't think I'm not sure if anything has been directly attributable, but the truth is it's not about like this is making people do things. It's about now they're identifying in a way, you know? So I think we saw that heavily after Columbine. That's probably one of the best examples, is that unfortunately people were seeing the two perpetrators of Columbine and saying, I'm doing this for them, I'm doing this like them. Mm-hmm. But of course it was all based on misinformation, right? Yeah. An active shooter, again, does a really good job of showing Columbine in this new light of like, basically this was a really failed operation. Like none of the bombs went off, like nothing went to plan. And the kids like didn't actually kill nearly as many people as they were trying to. They had this big elaborate thing and they basically utterly failed in this big elaborate plot. And all these kids afterward are like, I'm going to do it like them. And it's like, no, like this was a failure.
Don't do that. Those guys are super losers.
Yeah. Thank goodness it was a failure, because even more people would have died. Right. Like so many lives were affected by that in a horrible way. But you saw all of these like kind of copycats, and really in a lot of ways, it's because of how the media handled it.
Trenchcoat was like such a key piece.
Yeah. The Trenchcoat Mafia. And they like weren't even in it.
And so you're field host for Active Shooter, is that correct?
No. It hasn't even been on the air for years. I just really like it.
No, it sounds great.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, like coming from this kind of psych and neuroscience perspective, we don't always do a good job, I think, socially of trying to empathize even with bad people, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. I think we have this tendency. I read a study recently, actually it's been a couple of years now, about a construct that these psychologists called a belief in pure evil. And so they tested a bunch of people and they gave them this survey to assess whether or not they believed in the idea of pure evil. So like, is there good and evil in the world? Is evil an actual thing that exists?
Interesting question. Yeah.
And they found that people who actually believe in evil, that there are some good people and that there's some evil people, tended to be less likely to want to engage or to want to support rehabilitation efforts in prisons. They tended to be more likely to support the death penalty. So there are all of these interesting associations with the belief in good versus evil. Now, as somebody who, you know, is a non-believer, I'm an atheist who's, you know, is really interested in the brain, is really interested in human behavior, I don't believe in good and evil. I believe that things happen in people's lives and then things happen as a result of that. You can say that was a pretty evil act if you want to mean like that was a terrible thing and it's a really bad thing. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't think that there's like the devil was in these people.
I was gonna say pure evil implies not only that you believe in God, but that you believe in Satan he's doing these things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like living through this person. Practical.
The real anti-hero.
Yeah,
the first Joker.
The first Joker.
The original, the OG
Satan
Joker.
Satan was the first Joker.
The first Joker is the devil. Yeah. And he is real and he possesses people.
He's a trickster.
Yeah, he is a bad trickster. And before I forget, I wanted to go back because there is this implication, or like in the movie, we're not sure what he's imagining and what he's not at a certain point. And I think that for sure he's got to be imagining going into his neighbor's apartment because it was unlocked. That apartment was a piece of crap. How could you not triple lock your door?
No, see, I saw that as happening.
Okay.
Because, well, everything before where she was with him, I was like, well, this is definitely another a hallucination or something.
Which is funny because I didn't think so until they revealed that he had been hallucinating.
I was like, I guess she
feels really bad for
her. I was like, the daughter doesn't have a father. She's, maybe hard to meet people in the city.
You know what part I called bullshit? When she started laughing at his jokes on stage, I was like, that's not funny. you don't think that's funny. And that's not even, and there would be no reason for you to placate him either. So it's like I never bought she wouldn't fall for
I am definitely a schmuck for going along with that. I don't know why.
But also it was like a weird fantasy world, like it's Gotham but it's New York City. You know what I love the most, sorry to go off on this
tangent, please,
the garbage. I was like, that's what New York actually looks like.
And
it's the first movie I've ever seen where there's actually garbage on the street, every block.
Yeah.
Whenever I tell people about New York, especially people who like don't live in the U.S. who are coming to visit, and they're like, what's it like? I'm like, there's garbage everywhere.
Yeah, it's a there's terrible
garbage
dumpster city.
Absolutely. And like in Joker, it's Gotham City.
Yeah, and just like the weird steamy like fog.
Yeah, there's always steam coming out of like sewer
gross.
Holes.
Yeah. So there's like little puddles. People are stepping in puddles. I appreciated that.
The puddles were for sure.
The puddles felt real. Didn't they? There was no CGI.
I think they might have been real puddles.
Whoa.
Pretty trippy. Art department on that.
Okay, so I know this is an extraordinarily serious topic here, like very sad. And we're still going to be joking around. I can't help that. So I just wanted to say, like, this is very important. But I wanted to mention right at the beginning, the first thing that we see, he's working as a clown sign man. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that profession is called.
A professional clown.
Professional clown. Was, yeah. Okay. And they're like, in that position, you're forced to smile, to give this outward appearance of happiness, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys have ever experienced something like that. I had a job, I was only there for a week before I got fired, but I was at this like fancy restaurant job, and that was one of the things that they pushed on us constantly was smile. Smile when you're walking around, smile when you come to a table, you know, constantly smiling.
Have you ever done a photo shoot?
Also very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Also very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like people telling me when to emote.
Yeah.
But if they do tell you to emote, I'd much rather they tell me like look upset.
Yeah. Well, it's
look contemplative. Yeah. But right.
Look contemplative. Have no facial expression. Yeah.
Have no, just look completely
neutral.
Hey, can you
be just like a blank slate for a while?
Yeah.
You're doing great.
No problem.
No, so I was a high school cheerleader. So imagine the pressure and the amount of like through an entire game or through an entire performance, like your head would hurt and the girls would complain about it too.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Does that make you physically, sure, there's, you know, effects, but mentally I felt like, I don't know, like I was kind of losing it. Like I was putting on this really weird constant performance and it made me more upset than I was before. You know,
there are studies. There are these really classic studies where they tacked golf tees to people's heads at specific points on their face.
You're talking about a Clockwork Orange?
It wasn't like with tape. And so they would stick these golf tees on people's face, like, because you have all these muscles in your face, right? Yeah. Like so many more muscles in your face than anywhere else.
Yeah, our faces are jacked.
Yeah, they're amazing.
Your face is swole, to be honest.
And so instead of telling them smile, they would tell them like, touch the tees together or push the tees apart. So it would force them to make facial expressions that were emotive facial expressions without the affect part of it, right? So they're smiling, but they don't know they're smiling because they're just doing mental gymnastics.
Ooh, what a trick.
Yeah, and then they found that those people tended to rate feeling happier when they were making a smile face versus feeling more upset when they were making a frowning face. So there is probably, that's a learned experience, right? Because usually when we're happy, we do smile. Usually when we're upset, we don't.
Yeah.
So if we're going to make those facial expressions, it might evoke some of those emotions. I mean, take that as it will, right? It doesn't really mean that like forcing yourself into a mask of a smile is going to make you happy by any stretch. And you're right. I think pushing it too far can actually have the opposite effect.
Yeah.
It can actually make you resentful of the fact that you're not being authentic. And that's really what it is, right? You, like being forced to not be authentic, I think is going to make you upset.
Very few things do feel authentic. Well, you were waiting tables, right?
I was.
There's not a part of that that feels...
Authentic interactions with people.
Yeah, I tried to speak my mind to them. I mean, I didn't get much of a chance. I was there for a week. Yeah. But, you know, I tried my best. I tried my best to be me. You know,
it's tough to do.
Talk some crap.
I was back at the house for a long time. I had this one job shucking oysters, and
that was your job.
I shucked oysters.
You
for
got
like
paid to shuck
oysters.
Years.
Wow,
someone's got to do it.
That's a pro shucker.
Was this pre-podcasting?
No, it was during podcast, but I couldn't. You can't like wear earbuds in a kitchen.
Plus, you got to hear the sound of the shuck.
Yeah, you got to hear. That's how you know it's
why?
Open.
You're literally just shucking all day. You can't wear earbuds when you're shucking.
Well,
all day.
I also had to deliver oysters to customers, and like I had other responsibilities.
I feel like the sound engineer is going to be so pissed at you banging your hands on the table.
I'm sorry.
Good catch. It's a good catch.
I Italian family. I like to pound tables and talk.
He's just showing us the shucking.
Yes. He's been shucking this entire podcast.
But I remember one time a bartender came up to me and she was like, hey, Danny, do you want to, never mind. And I was like, what? She's like, I was going to ask if you wanted to like start bartending here, but you don't like talking to people. And I was like, I like talking to people.
Yeah.
And so I started bartending and I realized, oh, these people like really want to be like, tell me about their day and stuff.
Oh, it's like therapy.
And, like, they're like townies. I'm like, oh no, I'm not that type of bartender. I'm like, you need to talk to Kathy.
I'm not that type of bartender. I'm the type of bartender who makes drinks.
Oh, no, I'm not the friendly kind.
Yeah. No, I just want to like tweet on my phone in the corner. And then when you need something, like, I mean, there's a lot of people I did enjoy talking to, but there's some people who are like, I can't believe I have to entertain this motherfucker right now.
Yeah. And that's,
It's tough.
Yeah.
You're right. Like when it comes to the service industry, I think authenticity is like kind of lacking. But also I think that the most effective people are the authentic people, right? Like I'm always going to give somebody a tip when I feel like they meant it when they said thank you or here you go or have a good day,
right,
as opposed to somebody who I can tell is forcing it. And I guess this is something that's like really after my heart, because one thing we didn't talk about is that, so right now I'm in school, I'm working on my PhD in clinical psych, and it's my it's a weird way that you break up a psychology degree. So clinical means that I see patients and I'm working to get licensed so that I can work as a therapist. My concentration in my university is social justice and diversity. So I am a literal social justice warrior and I'm proud of it.
Awesome.
Take that, Twitter.
Now you're attacking Danny's Twitter.
Oh, no.
And then the third thing is that usually if you study psychology, you subscribe to a specific orientation. Like you learn psychology through a certain theoretical lens. Doesn't mean you're always going to practice at that lens, but they're, you know, most people are integrative, but you're usually either going to be psychodynamic, which is like psychoanalysis, that's more like Freudian psychology. You're going to be cognitive behavioral, which is like came out of the Skinner-Watson movement, which is much more about like changing behaviors and, you know, classical conditioning, that kind of thing, manualized treatments. That's a really common way to study psychology nowadays because it's all evidence-based, which is what like Medicare reimbursement wants or insurance reimbursement. And then there's this really weird orientation that I subscribe to, which is existential psychotherapy. And it's really heavily about authenticity and about like being you regardless, like not putting on a positive face just for the sake of doing it. Like I'm very anti this power of positive thinking movement. I think it's actually really detrimental for health and wellness. I'm super obviously interested in death and dying psychotherapy because that goes heavily with existential psychotherapy. But yeah, authenticity, very important to me.
I'm it's hard to be 100% authentic all the time.
Of
like
course,
I believe in small talk. I'm like, just let's, you know,
shoot the shit.
Yeah, cut the air a little bit.
But you can still have
like,
those little glimpses of people.
For sure. Yeah. But it's like, you know, just make an effort to talk to people. And
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
What do you think is a more powerful method than this, for lack of a better term, the secret type, power of positive thinking?
It's so dangerous, the secret, I think, personally. It's so dangerous. A better method, so the secret is all about, like, self-growth. And it's like a self-help kind of thing, right? That, like, if I put it out there in the universe that, like, good things are going to happen to me, then I'm going to, like, be rich. Which is very kind of like gross and narcissistic and self-fulfilling. And also it puts undue pressure on people. And I think ultimately downstream what you see, there's a great book by Barbara Ehrenreich called Bright Sided. And it's really about this. I think the subtitle is something like How the Power of Positive Thinking Movement is Undermining America.
It's a great title.
And it's like accelerated capitalism that's really unchecked and it really pushes for a lot of more greedy interactions. And one of the things that really resonates with me is that people who are dying of terminal illness, especially things like cancer, we have this way of talking about it as if they're fighters or they're not, they're survivors or they're not, they're victims. And there's a lot of pressure on people to maintain a positive outlook as if that has anything to do with whether or not they will live. Ultimately, they are going to live if the cancer allows them to live and the treatments that they get from their doctors allow them to live. And they are not if they're not. And there's so much pressure on these people that to maintain a positive outlook when they feel like shit. And you shouldn't have to maintain a positive outlook if you feel like shit. You should allow yourself to feel, you should die the authentic death you're going to die or live the authentic life you're going to live. And when we put that pressure on, there's this awful backlash where they actually feel worse because they can't fulfill this, unfulfillable ask of their families and of the medical professionals to like stay happy in face of something that's not fucking happy.
That makes me feel better about some of the, because like I have had family members with cancer before and stuff, and I'm always like, this is the last thing you want to talk about right now. So I'm going to try to divert your mind from anything. Like, how do you make someone just feel normal? Like, instead of thinking about it, because I know everyone else in my family and stuff, they're like, push it, and they can be a little, naggy about
it's
stuff
lot,
like that. How you feeling? And it's like,
I think it's also
it like try to take
like
them out of your head.
Stacking these, like putting stuff under the rug, it's just dangerous because then you have this like huge crap like in the back of your mind that you're ignoring, right?
And that's a really important component to the existential view of therapy is that we have these different reasons that people seek therapy because they're suffering. And it's about like, in some ways, kind of approaching the suffering, having a relationship with the suffering. It doesn't mean that you should always try to suffer. Of course not. We want to feel better. But the truth is, if the suffering is there and we're just ignoring it, it's going to keep coming back. But if we can start to understand it, if we can actually allow it to exist in a way that we can develop strategies for working with it, I think we're going to have, again, that more authentic outcome. And we might actually lead deeper lives because also I have the view that like, you don't really know love until you've had loss. You don't really know what it feels to be alive until you've actually had a mortality salient event. Like you've lost somebody, you've thought about your own death is going to help you but people who deny death, mm-hmm. I think ultimately are not living fully because they're not really capable of appreciating the fact that like this, you know,
it's
going to go away.
Yeah, it's going to go away.
So how do I, because I haven't had any sort of life-threatening thing, but how do I start appreciating life right now?
I think you just think about it.
I do think about it. I mean, I think about that stuff a lot because I've, you know, either family members with diseases or something.
That's
or like,
exactly
how I was in a car, I think it was also, a car crash once.
There
I was
you
like,
go.
Oh, dang. Yeah. But I was like, 23, I probably wasted the next 4 years after that.
And that's, yeah, young people don't.
That's the 20s. That's
young people don't have mortality. Yeah.
Right, I was going to say, it's like, if you are such like in denial in your 30s and beyond, then I think this is kind of an issue for you. Yeah,
but
like,
sure.
It should dawn on you naturally getting older, like, oh, this is fleeting.
It's going to happen.
I know more and more people that have either dealt with death themselves or are dead now.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, and what you see is that that's actually, there's actually a high.
Imagine being oblivious to that. Why is everyone, where's everyone going?
It's very common. There's the people who have a high denial rate actually tend to, on average, experience death terror. Like when it's actually their time, they're so afraid.
Oh,
it's like so hard to, you know, talk through it, to work through it, because they just cannot accept that it's happening.
So you should like microdose.
And there are some cool treatments available, which is good. I'm more into the talking about it side of things, but yes.
Dr. Palumbo. Prescribed acid.
There's actually a lot of experimental stuff with psilocybin and with MDMA right now in that end of life kind of processing. Just the equanimity and like the peace that you might have if you're like, you know.
Yeah, but we might as well start trying it now so that we can get ready.
Absolutely.
For later.
Ready. So I'm not terrified
when it comes.
When I'm done.
Yeah, I feel like I had both worlds going on. Like, I know the phrase is best of both worlds, but it's certainly not the best. But like my dad always prepared us when we were little by saying like death is just a part of life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a big, I'm always going to be here no matter what. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, from when I was very little.
Bad.
Whoa.
Like I'm never going to die. Like that's apparently a very bad thing to tell kids.
Yeah, tale to weave.
Yeah.
So I've always been like, oh, that, you know, if he believes in a very spiritual world, mm-hmm. where it's like everybody's still kind of hanging out,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I go that far, mm-hmm. but I do believe that it's like a natural, you know, we're all just running our course here. We're lucky for our time.
Yeah.
But, and my mom, and both of them are probably going to listen to this, which is horrible
for
me.
Your parents listen to your podcast? That's so sweet.
I know my mom does for sure. I don't know if my dad knows what a podcast is, but my mom does for sure. And she is a positive, powerful thinking person. And I don't think that's necessarily bad, mommy, but I do think that, you know, people can take it a little far. I think there's a good balance, right?
Yeah, it's not bad to think positively. That's
exactly. I think that when a terrible thing happens to us, it's important to go through it. It's important to like experience it. Don't ignore it, right? Like cry as much as you need to. Take your time.
Damn.
And then, you know, try to get yourself out of it,
and
not get stuck.
It's when the positive thinking movement suppresses anything negative that it becomes dangerous.
Yeah. Yes.
When it doesn't allow for authentic experience.
I don't know if I know many people that, where it's like, you're repressing a lot of negative feelings. A lot of the people I know that are in the power of positive thinking type stuff, I'm like, oh, they still have a good, healthy emotional relationship with those things that happen. But I can see that being when Kobe died, so many people were really embracing their, a lot of men.
Yeah,
I saw
like that.
It,
oh, sure.
Right? And a lot of people, you know, I text my mom. It's just like, there was tons of people that were like, you know, like, yeah, you should tell the people you love. And it was, so a lot of people embraced that.
Yeah.
And I was like,
I just think it's so important and not, it cannot be overstated that like when you are experiencing tragedy, depression, to like truly experience it. Take the time, cry. I always, if I am, I just allow myself as much time as I need. And then I inevitably will feel so much better. You know, like it's easier to keep going after that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just me and the chemicals in my brain.
No, it's important. And it's because we have this push in at least our Western society to like, let's say, you know, you're crying after you hear about Kobe and it like really affects you deeply, that like your roommate or your significant other or somebody who's close to you is like, don't cry. You know, just think about all of the good times that he had with his family. Just think about, it's like this, it's so uncomfortable for people to sit in negative affect that they want to do everything they can to try and like get it away.
That's why.
Like almost like it's damaging you. Like the sooner we can dry your tears, the sooner you won't have the scars of this emotional experience. And it doesn't work that way.
Right.
You know, maybe it's LA, but like most people I know now, I'm like, they're pretty... Like, I can't imagine anybody would be like, what are you crying for? They're all like, yeah, let it out.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you have like, a very different experience.
Maybe.
From
well,
people.
If this was like...
Friends.
If this is like... Pound on the table again. If this is like Pittsburgh, everyone would be like, what the fuck are you doing
now? Wait, do it in the accent. Do it in the accent.
Hey, what kind of hoagies in squat? I can't.
You can only talk about hoagies.
I can only, there's only a
but
few
a hoagie
things.
In a Pittsburgh, that can be anything. That could mean a lot of different things.
Potentially cry over a hoagie.
Yeah. Yes,
that's
that
fair.
Makes sense.
If it fell in a puddle or something.
I'm crying right now.
Pittsburgh tears.
Have you guys seen the film? I always tell people that they have to see this film. this is a podcast about bad science.
Oh, yeah.
Also, well, I'm going to tell you about some good science in a documentary.
Great.
Have you guys seen The Mask You Live In?
No.
It's a doc by Jennifer Siebel Newsom. Do you know who Jennifer Siebel Newsom is? She works with the Representation Project, and she made a really great doc called Misrepresentation. Also, I hate to like define somebody by who they're married to. She is famously married to Gavin Newsom, but she is also like, you know, I think she was an actress first, and then she works on all this stuff in her own right. And so she, this film, The Mask You Live In, is basically all about how we raise boys in modern society and how ultimately the way we raise boys turns into how men act.
Right.
And, you know, there is a reason that men commit the vast majority of violent crimes. There is a reason that men tend more often than women, not that women don't, to solve problems, you know, physically as opposed to verbally. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really interesting parallel, and it shows this cool program at San Quentin with juvenile lifers, so kids who committed murder prior to the age of 18,
wow.
Some cool rehab stuff that they're doing with their therapists and, like, you know, talking really openly about, like, my dad wasn't there. I didn't know what was the right thing to do when I, you know, joined this gang really young and blah, 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 and I felt the pressure to do X, Y, and Z, and now, like, I feel like shit because I took somebody's life, and now that I look back, I see that.
I wanted to ask you about it because I was watching the movie and also thinking about how, like, is there a way out for kids like that? Because it seems so vital that we have a good upbringing, that because it affects directly, you know, us as adults. So, like, what, you know, I mean, he was on like 7 different medications, they said in the movie, and going to some sort of therapist, it seemed like.
A social worker.
Yeah. And so obviously I'm sure that stuff is important. You know, people can get on antidepressants and, you know, go to a therapist. But it for me at least made the argument that, like, oh no, he's screwed. There's nothing.
There was something a little defeatist about it where you find out that his mother is diagnosed with these things.
Yes.
And, you know.
And there is a genetic component to a lot of, especially these more like psychotic disorders, because he's probably, I mean, I don't want to. I feel comfortable diagnosing a fictional character. I wouldn't want to do this with, like, a real person.
Sure.
And also, you know, who knows what the writer – they never said his diagnosis, and he's not a real person, so he's only unidimensional. Like, we only got what they gave us in the film.
Yeah.
I can't also then give him some assessments.
No, but properly diagnosed Joker.
Yeah, exactly.
You got it.
I think that he is probably, like, schizotypal personality disorder, something like that. So it's got, like, some schizophrenia features, because there was obviously psychosis. There were delusions.
Right.
He was seeing himself in a relationship with his neighbor, and we know that that wasn't real, ultimately. So there was reality testing issues there. We also know that mom had some psychotic features, and so there was a genetic link there.
Although he might be adopted, that's who's
interesting
to say.
Too. Yeah, he might be adopted. But either way, there's environmental factors, the heavy genetic and environmental factors there, the nature-nurture thing. But also, it does seem to be a little bit more like a persistent personality disorder, because he was also taking antipsychotics, I think. He was on so many meds. I'm going to assume that some of them were like antipsychotics, and he was still having a lot of these features, and they were really, really pervasive. Like, they affected his sense of self.
Right?
And so that's like kind of the difference between a personality disorder, which tends to be harder to treat. They tend to be a little bit more pervasive. They tend to follow you throughout the lifespan, as opposed to some of these other disorders. I think that one of the sad things, and I can speak to this maybe from a little bit of experience, because right now in my practicum, I'm working with kids in foster care. So I work at a group home. Actually, now it's converted to a short-term residential treatment program. So kids who live in the home, who are there oftentimes, more often than not, by no fault of their own. You know, it's because their parents are the fucking worst.
Yeah.
So either mom and dad got arrested for violence, abuse, sexual abuse. A lot of the, you know, girls that I see have sexual abuse histories, physical abuse histories. And, you know, sometimes it's because they themselves have mental illness and the behaviors became too much for mom and dad to handle. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, it's because CPS was involved. Child Protective Services removed the children from the home because they were neglected or abused. Or sometimes they sadly were orphaned, like their parents died. And so that's how they ended up in the foster care system, because there's no other adults in their life who were in a position to take them on. And one thing that I see is that for some kids, the system really works. They get placed with a good foster home, or they get adopted early. They get the services that they need. You know, they get therapy and it's free. They get to go to college for free. And it's amazing. For some kids, I think, who have become really stigmatized by the system, they end up a little bit worse for wear, because they end up going to jail when maybe if they hadn't been in that situation, they wouldn't have gone to jail, because there'll be a tiff in a house and they'll get arrested for it, or they'll hit, you know, staff member or something.
Oh,
in a
foster
in
house?
A home, or they'll get in fights with other kids. And sometimes what ends up happening is that you have a situation where there are kids who are really dominant and you have kids who are like more passive. And so sometimes a sweet, more passive kid might start to be influenced unduly by kids who have somewhat more like antisocial behaviors and or like the drug use. The CSEC issue, commercial sexual exploitation of children, is a big issue in the foster care system because these kids are really vulnerable. And so, you know, I work with girls. And so teenage age girls are more likely, if they have histories of sexual abuse, to meet older men who treat them like queens, who give them things they never had before. And they're more likely to sell or to be victimized basically by traffickers. We don't call them pimps anymore. We call them traffickers. And so you do see these cycles, unfortunately, where being in the system, the longer they're in it and the more stigmatized they get, the more diagnoses, the more meds, the more they get bounced around from social worker to social worker, from school to school. It's unstable. They don't have loving parents. We are in a home, for example, where we're not allowed to touch them. It's a hands-off facility. So in a way, that's great because nobody can put hands on them and nobody can actually hurt them. And a lot of kids actually are hurt by adults in foster care through restraining, through, you know, lock-ins, through things like that. It's horrible. So I work in a no-touch facility, which I like, but I also can't hug them, which is like terrible. These kids need to be held, you know, and they need to be told that they're loved. And if they were growing up in a family environment, whether it was one mom, one dad, a mom and dad, two moms, two dads, or even more extended family around, they would be loved all the time. They would be held.
So then do you kind of attribute some of that to a broken, is that like a broken system or a system that needs desperately fixed?
Yes, in a way, but also there's only so much you can do when the parents fucking suck, right? And the sad thing is that half the reason, not half, the majority of the reason that most of the parents suck is because they were born into it. So there's this vicious, horrible cycle of parents being abused by their parents, being neglected by their parents, being involved in, you know, gangs or things like that, because that's the only social system that they could find. Yeah, yeah. That's the only support that they could have. Obviously, a lot of this comes from being in poverty. So in that way, the system is broken. Like, the American social system is broken. The fact that we don't have free healthcare, the fact that we don't have free education, the fact that there are horrifically institutionalized racial and like racism and sexism within our systems, that I think is the system that needs to be that needs to be fixed. Because if we actually see a more egalitarian system where we take care of the most vulnerable among us, we'll start to break the cycles. But we don't. We put them away in places where we can't see them, and we give them the minimal services that we're able to give them. And then these kids do as well as they can. But there are days when I see a kid and I'm like reading the file and I'm like, this kid must be a monster. Oh, God, it's going to be weird to sit down. And then I sit across from her for an hour and I'm like, how is she still standing with all the horrible shit that ever happened to her? Wow. The fact that she has a smile on her face and she's like telling me thank you after we meet for an hour. Like, if you read her file, there's a massive mismatch with who this girl actually is, because we stigmatize them in a massive way.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Sorry, we got things heavy here on the Bad Science Comedy Podcast.
I knew going in this episode was going to go there.
For sure.
Yeah. I had a feeling we were all in for it.
Yeah. So I would say the thing that we approach as humanistic therapists, so people who kind of like subscribe to my orientation, is the Carl Rogers approach to therapy, which is unconditional positive regard and a non-judgmental stance. So the most important thing in therapy, we think, is the relationship between the therapist and the client, or the person served, or the patient, whatever you want to, you know, different views have different social justice ideas of what we should call the people we work with. But unconditional positive regard, meaning it's my patient. I don't care if they're a pedophile. I have to approach them as if they deserve my full attention and respect. I can't go in being like, ooh, he's a fucking pedophile, which is really tough, right? Because they're my client. And a non-judgmental stance, the same kind of thing. I have to go in saying, what you've been through, what you've done, it is what it is. We're going to work on it. And we're going to work on how we can change our relationships with it, which is not easy for a lot of people who work with offenders.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only way it'll work, though,
it's the only way.
Is a bottom dollar, you know, bottom line, everyone gets treated.
And I think what they're showing in the Joker when he has these services available to him, when he has these services available to him, is that they're not being utilized appropriately.
Right,
so even though, and the problem is she has too many cases. You know, her caseload is overwhelming. Yeah. She's, you know, checked out. She's been doing it for too long.
Yeah, the facilities didn't look top class.
It's not great. But ultimately, she's going through the motions. She's doing the checklist, making sure the meds are fine and letting. And there's that scene where she's like, do you have any negative thoughts? He's like, you don't listen. All I have are negative thoughts. You're not listening to me.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, in that way, the system is broken. Mm-hmm. There's not enough funding. There's not enough people who are willing to work for fucking nothing.
Yeah.
For nothing. I'm telling you, if I were to continue in the foster system once I become a licensed psychologist, I would make tops $25 an hour. As a person who went to school for 15.
Wow. Yeah,
that's wild.
That's insane. Like
it's amazing. So how, unfair. And then you wonder why there aren't more PhD level and PsyD level people working in these industries. It's because they're like, oh, but I could go to Beverly Hills and make $400 an hour.
And this pays 25 for like people that like really need
it. We don't incentivize
it. It's the worst.
And you can't blame them. So I think—
Another reason sports sucks, by the way. Just throwing that out there. Guys are getting like $100 million to throw a ball. Yeah. Just saying.
True. But also people like Kobe, who I will give props to. Yeah. And it's a complicated history with his sexual abuse stuff. But people like Kobe at least took that and did the right thing, which was he became a massive community leader.
Right.
And I think that's what you see with a lot of lawyers, a lot of psychologists, is that they'll do the job that pays well so that they can then go and also do the pro bono work.
Yes.
Knowing that the system is not incentivized. So they just have to half-half it.
Right, right. But it still doesn't change, like you're saying, the salaries of all these people that are on the front line.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
And it's easy not to fund this stuff if we don't remember that these people exist. People literally think that childhood sexual abuse or that sex trafficking is like something that only happens in developing countries. And it's like, trafficking is a massive problem in America. It's a massive problem in Los Angeles because they think of trafficking as like, you know, a kid from Thailand being sold into sex slavery. They don't think of like pimps and hoes. Like we actually look at it like a hoe or a prostitute is like a choice. Mm-hmm. We look at it like these kids weren't struggling their whole lives. Like they weren't, you know, in many ways forced into this kind of situation.
Yeah.
And we actually use those terms, you know, and obviously this is a difference between the sex positive sex worker movement, which is very different. We're talking about legal sex work there. I don't know, man. We forget. We lock these kids away. We put them in special schools. We put them in special houses. And we're like, oh, yeah, dad, you know, systematically raped and abused this girl from the time she was born. Ew. I don't want to sit with that. I don't want to think about that. So we'll just pretend it doesn't exist.
And then you go in there, judge-free, 15 years of education, into the trenches, helping these people from the ground up. And Danny writes about chicken parm.
That's it.
You know what?
That's what I do, baby.
You know what?
But I'm pretty good at it.
I can really describe that bread.
I'm pretty good at it.
But here's the thing. This is not me just trying to make you feel better, I promise.
No. You don't have to.
That kind of shit, though, is the shit that actually does make the world better. It's like, it sounds silly.
All right.
You know what? You're right.
I'm trying.
Say no more.
You're right. Trying to sit here and undo horrible damage, right? But the reason that the world is a happy, healthy place generally, and the reason that people really enjoy are like simple pleasures. I really think so.
Dude, I will say, and I truly believe this about cooking too, is like I was a cook for a long time, and I'm like, there's so many times I don't know what's the best way to like show somebody your gratitude or show somebody you care. And I'm like, oh no, it's like make pasta and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, you know,
and do
like,
it with your kids. Like we do it in the group home all the time.
Yeah.
A lot of the 100%. Girls cook and they cook for the other residents and it's a really loving experience. Wow. It's a way to do therapy too. It's like cook together, be together.
I've had comics over for dinner before and I remember one time.
Weird and never had an invitation.
Yeah. I mean like what? Now though, that's you know,
weird.
I'll put you in the queue.
In the rotation, A couple years from now, I'll report back to you.
So many people get pissed at me because they see like an Instagram story where I'm making pasta and they're like, you had this person over?
What?
Not me? I'm like,
that guy's not funny?
Yeah.
This pasta must be amazing.
Yeah. It looks good.
It's fine. But I remember I had a comedian over one time and he like sat down at a table with like five other people. He's like, I haven't had like a dinner. I don't even think as a kid. Like he grew up in a broken home. He's like, I don't know if I've ever like sat down for dinner before.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's wild.
That's big.
And it's huge. I mean, it's hugely helpful to be like sit across from somebody, eat with them, thank them, show your gratitude, cook the food together, clean up afterward. There's so many of these like life skills that we try to teach, right? Kids who never got a chance to do them through worksheets and through conversations that you just can't teach without just doing it.
Yep.
Just being present.
So huge. I mean, there's a reason it's like the most ancient, you know, breaking bread is like so important. It's like such a sensory experience. The smell and the taste. You get to talk. You just sit there.
Yeah.
Put your iPad down.
It's a food podcast now, baby.
Yeah.
So what do you put in your bolognese?
Oh, buddy.
I'd love to know.
And also, you know, this idea of like recipes as like a meme, kind of like a recipe being passed down from generation to generation. It's a funny thing because in my mind, I'm sitting here seeing this alternate parallel, this paradoxical parallel with you know, mental illness or with violence or like these cycles of abuse. You also see these cycles of, you know, really kind of bringing people together and these cycles of respect and gratitude.
Yeah.
And so, it's the same, but the opposite, right? Yeah, like mm-hmm. being together as a family and just like basically tell your kids how much you love them all the time.
Yeah. And make some garlic bread and
show them you love them all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Don't say I love you, just make the garlic bread.
Do both.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Do both.
Well, I mean, you can do both. You can do both, but the garlic bread is just as good. Just as good.
Okay. All right.
Do both.
Speaking for my father.
It's not one or the other.
We had a great relationship.
No, that makes sense that you have such a wonderful experience. You want to replicate that experience, also give it to somebody else. Like, that's huge. Okay, great. I'm going to check on the time. Yeah, I knew we were running out of time. It just felt like
That's so sad.
I know, it is sad.
If only Joker had garlic bread with his mom.
Oh my God, good call. Yeah.
Dang.
Didn't seem like they had many good meals in that little apartment.
No, he was like feeding her.
Interesting. What were they eating? TV dinners, right? Was it something?
It was supposed to be 1981, I read.
Yes.
So they were like old TV dinners.
Yes.
That's true. As a promo plug section here, Danny, where can people find you?
Oh, man,
where can they see you?
Twitter and Instagram, probably the best place to find me. Palumbros, Palumbros. It's also the website. And
do you share that with a brother of yours?
No. I think Danny Palumbo was taken, and then I don't know, that kind of came up. And
there's another Danny Palumbo.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a bunch.
Really?
That guy sounds cool.
There's another one on Twitter. I mean, I'm probably the cooler one. I don't know what he does.
But Palumbros is the cooler one.
There's another one out there.
Okay, Kara, obviously Brain Games is coming out on a specific date at a specific time,
so
I'm sure.
As of listening to this, Brain Games is already out, and there's some really incredible episodes. They're all themed. So each Monday at 9, 8 Central, you can see it on National Geographic Channel, like basically all over the world. It's so much fun. You have to check it out. And if you want to, check out my podcasts, it's TalkNerdy.com, KaraSantaMaria.com. There's a million ways to just Google Talk Nerdy and Skeptic's Guide. And same thing, Twitter and Instagram, at KaraSantaMaria.
Oh,
it's weird. We share. Yeah, it's weird.
The same. So there is, and you are sharing.
Yeah. That's Kara with a C because you can't see it because you're listening to me. At KaraSantaMaria on Twitter and on Instagram, at KaraSantaMaria was taken because I was late to the party. So there are underscores in there. But weirdly, I Googled once and I think I'm the only Kara Santamaria in America.
Whoa.
Which is, I have a weird name, right?
So who the hell is this other one?
I know. So maybe there's another one, but she's like not showing up on the census.
Okay. We'll track her down.
Well,
we're going to get some PIs on her.
We're going to make some noise. No, let's not. Guys, be nice. Be nice on the internet.
Do not attack the other Kara Santamaria.
She's really a perfectly sweet girl. Please don't do
anything. No one's
going to
dox anybody.
Yes,
very anti-Joker.
Yes. No, of course. Follow both of these wonderful people. They're fantastic. Subscribe to Talk Nerdy and watch Brain Games. And we'll get back together for Joker 2.
And pasta.
Oh my God, honestly.
If I would love to.
Chicken Farm and Joker 2.
I'll bring the mics and the preamps and headphones and
I would
stuff,
love to.
And we'll go to your place and we'll all eat.
Perfect.
What will I bring?
Fork?
Yeah, whatever. Forks? That's the thing. I don't have forks.
Oh, good. I'm on it.
You normally eat with your hands? It's really weird. All right. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburg. Our associate producer is Emily Feld. Our editor is Lucas Bollinger. And the executive pro dancing on the stairs deucer is Brett Kushner. Follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Show. That's at Bad Science Show. Or feel free to send us an email, badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com. Let us know what you think about the show, any movies we should do in the future. I always appreciate getting your emails. And of course, leave us an iTunes review. That lets other people hear about the show. And I'll see you all next week. Bye.